Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Great to have you with us on this Friday, and you know what Friday means. Film Week comes up in the next hour. We'll hear what our critics think about Richard Linklater's new film, Where'd You Go, Bernadette? Adapted from Maria Semple's very popular novel, Cate Blanchett stars. Also, the Angry Birds movie 2. We'll hear what animation critic Charles Solomon and our other critics think about that. And Good Boys, a comedy rated R, despite the fact the three protagonists are sixth grade boys. That's all coming up, along with other films on Film Week next hour. But first, we begin with an incident that tragically unfolded on Monday, in which California Highway Patrol officer Andre Moye was shot and killed by a suspect whose car was being impounded. He grabbed a rifle out of the vehicle and shot, killing the officer. Now, the father of the shooter in the incident says his son was despondent, going through a number of psychological crises in his life, and that he believes his son was suicidal. This brings to the fore again the issue of what's dubbed suicide by cop, those who turn on law enforcement officers in an effort to get the officers to kill them because the individuals are suicidal. In a recent Los Angeles Times piece by Anita Chabrier, it lays out how a number of California police departments are rethinking the traditional way of responding to despondent calls coming from family members or friends concerned about the well-being of someone close to them. Anita, thank you for joining us to talk about your piece in the Times.
Oh, thank you for having me on.
So you talked with different people in law enforcement, and so what seems to be the growing sense about whether police should respond to these calls?
Well, I want to be really clear that all agencies are continuing to respond to calls like the incident that happened with the CHP. That was actually a traffic stop where there's a public safety issue for other people, or there's an actual crime going on or something like that. Where they're rethinking what they're doing are in welfare checks, where someone would call and say, I think my son or my husband or my daughter is suicidal. Can you please come help? With those kind of calls, you're seeing departments take a different approach. In smaller agencies, some of them are simply saying, we are not the best person to respond to this. We're not going to come out. And in larger agencies, you're seeing a push towards some kind of joint response between mental health professionals and the police, simply because a lot of times if it's just officers responding to these situations, they do escalate to violence.
Well, and I would think even with larger departments who have the resources to take mental health professionals out, you know, with the officers, there's even a time element there because you've got officers who might be on patrol who could quickly respond to a call of a despondent individual. They're not necessarily going to have that degree of, you know, quick access to a mental health pro to be a part of that team. And did the larger departments talk about that challenge?
Absolutely. I mean, it is very rare still, you're correct, to have that kind of joint response. But one thing that is interesting is that police across the state are saying that being there quickly isn't always the best thing. So that there is a benefit to taking a step back, to assessing the situation, to giving time and space to these calls, to make sure that you're not having to de-escalate and that you don't, and instead you're not escalating in the first place.
You write in your piece that a fairly high percentage of engagement between law enforcement officers' use of force are these incidents where police say that, you know, it's an individual's essentially trying to kill him or herself by attacking the officers. So what you know, how frequent is this?
Well, there's two sides of that. One side of it is that there is a strong feeling from some in the community that suicide by cop is too often used as an excuse for escalation, that it is something that is very hard to pin down because many times the person who is perhaps has committed suicide by a cop or done that is, you know, they can't tell you what they were thinking. So there is that sense that maybe it's a term that's too often used, and it hasn't been studied too much. But there was one 2009 study that looked at 707 cases across the country of officer-involved shootings and found that 36% of those were a suicide by cop situation. So it potentially is a large percentage of officer-involved shootings that has this mental health component to it.
Yeah, and it doesn't seem like it would be that hard to come up with some degree of accuracy in the numbers. If you've got someone, a call's come in that they're suicidal or despondent, they're armed and confronting law enforcement officers. I mean, obviously you could make the case that law enforcement could do more to de-escalate a particular incident, but isn't that kind of a separate issue as to whether the person is attempting to get the officer to kill him or herself?
It just gets complicated, as all mental health things do. What the study found is that a lot of the suicide by cop situations were not pre-planned. Maybe it was someone who was despondent and then in the moment became aggressive. The study did find is that of those suicide by cop situations, 80% of them were armed, 60% of them were armed with a gun. So it is a volatile situation that is difficult for officers to handle.
We're talking with Los Angeles Times reporter Anita Chabrier. She's based in Sacramento, covers state politics, but wrote a very interesting piece just about a week ago now in the LA Times that's titled Police Fear Suicide by Cop Cases, So They've Stopped Responding to Some Calls. And she highlights the Plumas County Sheriff's Office. Sheriff Coroner Greg Hagwood joining us to talk about his department's policy. Now, Plumas County is a rural area, Sierra Nevada area. Sheriff Hagwood, thank you very much for being with us. What's your new policy for these calls?
Our new policy is designed around the goal of creating a success rate for people in psychiatric crisis that if there is a situation where other individuals are at risk or being threatened, of course, our obligation is to keep people safe. Individuals who are threatening suicide, who are alone, who are not posing a threat to anybody besides themselves. Our policy is geared around accessing different resources and not creating a confrontation that, as has been pointed out, there are countless examples of, I think, unnecessary confrontations that end up with the individual either dying or being injured. And the whole goal is to prevent those confrontations when possible.
So your concern is that when you have deputies who go out on a call for someone who's suicidal and might be armed, that it would make it worse to have deputies arrive on the scene than if they don't show?
Very often we see time and time again examples where officers show up with the best intentions, but the actions or intents of the individual compel a confrontation that has a very, very poor outcome. And I have stated that, you know, historically law enforcement officers and I think the public look to us to be the solution to all problems. And in these circumstances, I believe that there's probably a better way of dealing with a person in a psychiatric crisis than having a direct confrontational experience with armed sheriff's deputies or police officers.
Let me bring into the conversation Pepperdine University Associate Professor of Psychology, Judy Ho, who's licensed clinical and forensic psychologist. Professor Ho, good to have you back with us. What options are there for family members if in some of these departments, particularly in rural areas where, you know, there aren't psychological teams to go out with deputies or with police officers? What's available to family members if they've got someone who's despondent and armed and, you know, threatening to kill themselves? Where do families turn?
So this is a very good question, Larry, and I think that families oftentimes don't know what they can do and they feel hopeless about their ability to help these individuals. But, you know, being connected with that person is key, and keeping tabs on them, calling them, showing up at their house, asking to take them out to be with other family members and friends so that you can really get a, you know, a handle on the pulse of what's going on. And at the same time, if you're not sure how to handle or approach an individual who is saying that they wish to die or is actually even planning some kind of plot to hurt themselves, it's always helpful to call a National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. Those hotlines are not just for the people who are feeling suicidal. They're for the family members to also get advice on how to handle it and how to deal with it in a way that may or may not need to escalate to a point where they have to involve local law enforcement. And so the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline is 800-273-8255, and they're available 24 hours every day. And I've had many patients whose families have gotten a lot of great advice from talking to one of the advisors on these calls, and sometimes we'll even initiate the call and then go over to the family member's house who's talking about hurting themselves and then have them engage in that call together. So I think that that is, you know, one really good way to approach this. Another way, if the family member is concerned and the person who is suicidal is still willing to engage with a family member but doesn't want to go too much further than that, is for the family member to ask them whether or not they would be willing to accompany them to an emergency room. And sometimes when they are asked to do this, the person who wants to hurt themselves is willing to do it if the family member will go with them. And so the family member holds their hand, drives them, takes them every step of the way, and they go to the emergency room together to get evaluated, possibly for admission for a 5150. And of course, that is not necessarily, you know, a long-term treatment plan, but it at least helps the individual to not hurt themselves in that moment when they're very, very despondent. I also want to say that these research studies that we have on individuals who do attempt suicide by cop, that oftentimes there's other things in their history that, you know, would be important to address. For example, there's more than 50% of them in some of these studies that show that they're at the time intoxicated on alcohol or drugs, which of course then really might sort of kind of cut into their impulse control and make them make more rash decisions in the moment. And so that's clearly something that's very important to address. And interestingly enough, one of these studies also has shown that individuals who really talk about a high degree of religiosity sometimes will be in such a dire situation to think about utilizing this concept, because in their mind they believe that if they take their own life, then they might not gain access to the afterlife, but that if somebody else does it to them, then perhaps they still could. And it's interesting talking to these individuals, you know, afterwards and talking about their state of mind at the time, what led them to do that in that moment, that those are some of the concerns. And so I think kind of knowing that some of these things are risk factors or things that we should at least address and talk about with these individuals who want to harm themselves would be important.
Professor Ho, thank you very much. Appreciate your being with us again on Air Talk.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you.
Associate Professor of Psychology at Pepperdine, Judy Ho, joining us. She has a new book out next week, Stop Self-Sabotage. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. We're going to continue our conversation on what's dubbed suicide by cop. where someone who is threatening his or her life comes at police officers in the hopes that they will be killed in that confrontation and that they don't have to turn the weapon on themselves, take their own life. Question is, how should law enforcement respond to those calls that come in with someone who is despondent? What we heard from the Plumas County Sheriff and Coroner Greg Hagwood is that if there's a case where no one else is being threatened by the person that is suicidal, they are not going to come out immediately out of concern that that encounter may make the situation worse. We'll be back in 1 minute on Air Talk. How should law enforcement respond to calls of despondent individuals who are armed, threatening harm to themselves? That's the question taken up in a Los Angeles Times piece by Anita Chabrier, a piece that looked at a number of different departmental policies and how those law enforcement agencies choose to respond to those calls. At Plumas County in the Sierra Nevada Hills, they've made a conscious decision that if there's not an imminent threat to other individuals by the person who is at risk of harming him or herself, they will not immediately come out and engage with the individual out of concern that it makes the situation worse. With us, retired Los Angeles Police Department Sergeant Cheryl Dorsey. She worked with the LAPD, rising the rank of sergeant between 1980 and 2000. Sergeant Dorsey, good to have you with us again. What do you think is the best way for police to respond to calls of despondent individuals threatening self-harm?
Well, you know, having spent 20 years in patrol and responded and been involved in incidents like this, I know personally firsthand that sometimes people are really just asking for help. It's a cry for help. It's a way to get attention. And I've been involved in situations where our officers have been successful in talking someone down, in getting them to get off that ledge or come off of the rooftop of that building. And so to think that a police department, someone who has taken an oath to protect and serve, would not respond because you're fearful of your presence being confrontational and causing this situation to exacerbate is offensive, and it's cowardly. This is what police officers are trained and expected to do. It's inherent to what we do. And so if you're confident in your skill set and your training and you rely on that, why wouldn't you respond to help someone who's in need? And if this is the policy of police departments across the nation now to not respond because they don't want to upset somebody, it would be nice if they use that same mindset when folks are calling the police unnecessarily on Black people who are just living while Black, that new term, and exacerbate the situation. So listen, there's a way to do this. We should do this. And I hope that police officers won't refuse to respond when someone calls them and asks for their assistance.
Well, one of the concerns, of course, that we hear from law enforcement is they're damned if they do, they're damned if they don't. If they respond and the suicidal individual, you know, comes at them while armed or raises a weapon to get them, the officer has to respond to protect her, himself, or you know, colleagues in a situation like that. Is it fair to the officers to have to be in that position to kill someone because that individual is at that point in his or her life where they want to end it?
Well, listen, here's the problem with that is that we don't know ever what someone's intent is when we interact with them. We don't know what an intent is. Obviously, recently in Riverside, California, a traffic stop, something that should be relatively simple and easy, and it turned into an officer losing his life. So we have to rely on our training, and that's why officers are trained the way that they are, because instances and circumstances can change in a moment. And so, listen, I say all the time that everybody who wants to be the police should not be the police. Some of what we do is unavoidable. And if someone points a weapon at an officer, that officer has the affirmative responsibility to defend himself and should defend himself. And then, you know, let the chips fall where they may. We didn't precipitate that use of deadly force. And so I think if you are well trained, as we are in the Los Angeles Police Department, we trust our training, we'll trust our instincts, and we can respond to any and every call appropriately, and it will end in the way that it's supposed to. And if it ends in a death, then it ends in a death. That's part of the territory. It comes with the job.
We're talking with Cheryl Dorsey, retired sergeant with the Los Angeles Police Department. Also with us, Greg Hagwood of the Plumas County Sheriff's Office, where he is the sheriff, as well as the county coroner. Sheriff Hagwood, you want to respond to what Sergeant Dorsey just said?
Every situation, no two situations are identical. I am simply looking at those incidences, those situations where there might be a better address to the individual in crisis than an armed law enforcement officer. Is there a better resource from a behavioral health expert, people who specialize in people in psychiatric crisis? Now, law enforcement officers are increasingly better trained, and I welcome that trend in terms of de-escalation and not forcing unnecessary use of force. But there are instances that I think are better addressed by someone other than an armed law enforcement officer. And this policy is not being utilized, not just in California, but across the country, out of cowardice. It is being examined and implemented in a sincere effort to have a better outcome and reduce the possibility of a use of force.
But isn't time of the essence in these cases? So, yes, ideally there'd be someone specially trained in just these kinds of incidents, mental health professional who you'd be able to, you know, call on, or a family member could call on right away. They dispatch in the same way one of your deputies would go out to the call. But just realistically, you've got a family member who says, my loved one has gone out to the garage with his gun, and I fear that, you know, he's going to hurt himself. Wouldn't a deputy who's ideally trained in de-escalation and helping to talk someone through that life crisis be able to get there and potentially successfully intervene more quickly than a mental health professional?
I think in terms of response, obviously on-duty law enforcement officers have the ability to arrive at a situation in a more timely fashion than a mental health or behavioral health specialist. The goal is to reduce the confrontation. And if there is a way to communicate with that individual without anybody being put at risk, if somebody has a firearm and they are threatening suicide and they're alone, yeah, we could show up and they could point the gun at us and we would return fire and perhaps kill that individual. The idea that that's just the course of business, I think I just can't subscribe to that just being the cost of doing business. I think there are better ways to address these situations. I think you're going to see approaches, policy, training continue to evolve. And to the extent that this is the destination and we've arrived there when it comes to addressing these situations, I think we have to look at constantly improving, constantly evaluating, but at the same time doing everything we can to avoid these unnecessary deaths.
We're talking with Greg Hagwood, who's Plumas County Sheriff as well as coroner. Let me go back to LA Times reporter Anita Chabrier. Anita, is much of this a rural versus urban divide in law enforcement approach?
Absolutely not, which is what I find fascinating about it. You're going to see we're about to change our use of force here in California. There, we had a bill, 392, many people have heard about. The governor's going to get ready to sign it, that updates use of force in California. That actually came out of much of what's in that bill came out of a suicide response in San Diego County in 2006 for a man named Shane Hayes, where deputies there were called to a suicidal man. They went into the house, and the gentleman had a knife in his hand. It was not clear that he was threatening anybody, but officers felt threatened, and they fired and killed him. What that did, that case went through civil litigation, and it made it so that in California on the civil side, what an officer does leading up to the deadly confrontation can be examined in a civil case. Prior to that, it was only the moment of death that could, was that person a danger at the moment of death? 392 will make that, bring that to the criminal side. So starting very shortly in California, what an officer does leading up to the deadly confrontation can be examined for, were they proper in their tactics and their response? And so I think that across the state, there's going to be even greater emphasis than there already is on what officers are doing leading up to the deadly force. So I think that this is actually the start of a larger conversation on how our police respond when they face deadly threats.
And then on the opposite side of that, if you have departments that routinize not responding to calls of individuals in crisis, unless there is someone else who's threatened by that individual, could that open up the door to liability from the other direction?
Of course. I mean, I think that it's going to be an interesting conversation because many of the people I spoke to, including George Quinn's family, the gentleman who did kill himself in Plumas County, feel that they deserve help, that they're not the right person to be doing this, and that let's say that had been a suicide by cop situation, were they better equipped to confront someone with a weapon? So I definitely think that this is going to be an ongoing conversation in a developing situation.
Let me quickly go back to Cheryl Dorsey, retired LAPD sergeant. Sergeant Dorsey, to your knowledge, is there much training of law enforcement officers going through the academy or in-service training to deal with these kinds of scenarios?
Well, you know, I can't speak to the 18,000 police departments that are across the nation because everyone is different, and I understand that. But I've often said that poor tactics lead to deadly uses of force. And so this is something, this AB 392 being passed, and I spoke on Capitol Hill on the state capitol about this because I think officers should give great consideration to the tactics that they use leading up to a situation. When we get to a scene, it's our responsibility to deal with a situation, confront violence, if you will, uncooperative people, and then de-escalate. And a lot of times what we're seeing is that officers get personally invested, whether the person is mentally ill or not, and then it becomes a mission of, I'm going to punish you because you didn't comply, because you didn't turn around, because you ran. And so the tactics are very, very important, and it should give an officer reason to pause before they take a life, before they use deadly force.
I want to thank you, Sergeant Cheryl Dorsey, retired LAPD sergeant. My thanks to Los Angeles Times reporter Anita Chabrier, whose piece on this just shy of a week ago looked at how different California law enforcement agencies are dealing with those in mental health distress threatening self-harm. Also, our thanks to Greg Hagwood, Plumas County Sheriff, as well as coroner, and Judy Ho, professor of psychology at Pepperdine University. We'll continue looking at an important new study about the effects of air pollution on the lungs of older Americans. That after a live update from Hedy Lynn Herdes.